Well, hello and welcome to what is a Wednesday webcast, but with maybe out without the webcast. It's National Adoption Week, and it's all a bit gone a bit wrong. Because Scott, where are you right now?
I'm in Milton Keynes. Blood.
Yeah.
But where will I be
when
next
this
week?
Goes out?
Yeah.
Where are you when this goes out?
I will be on a cruise ship sailing around the Med for 7 days, and I cannot wait. Now, anybody who's listened for years will know that I holiday like 5-6 times a year, and I've not been able to do it for 2 years, so I am looking forward to this holiday.
Making the best of it.
I definitely am,
Sarah Johal, if you're listening, by the way. Yeah. She has to keep quiet, but she can't help herself. We've broken that the facade.
Sorry.
It's fine, you hear, and we're with Sarah Johal. Yeah. Hiya, Sarah.
Hi, Al. Hi, Scott. How are you guys doing?
Yeah, not bad. Welcome back, friend of the show.
I do have a confession, though. I am mildly traumatised as I fell into a slight conversation with my 10-year-old about the birds and the bees about 2 minutes before we pressed record.
Oh, dear.
Needed more time, really, maybe.
Yeah.
Well, she's thoroughly disgusted. And I'm mildly traumatised. So,
but what is she thoroughly disgusted by? Your kind of discussion about it, or the fact that that stuff goes on?
Yeah, she said, "You've told me enough." She said, "Can we talk about something
else now?"
Oh, dear.
I think I dodged it with the other five. I mean, I've done.
I was going to say, you've done it five times already. If this one's traumatised you, then there must have been something new in there.
The conversation involved hens and eggs and.
Oh, apples, okay.
Mm-hmm. Which seemed like, well, we've got hens, and so the analogy is, if what we say is like, oh, look, got hens. You know how they produce eggs? Oh, yes, we do. Well, that women produce eggs. All right, okay, but if. The hens, because we don't have a cockerel. If the hen, and anyway, let's not go there. I'm re-traumatizing.
You're going to re-traumatize yourself now.
I'm going to ask you about that in the future as well, just to see what the explanation is, because I know about all the hens and all that sort of stuff as well, just to see if you've got it right. I mean, it'd be quite funny to listen to.
Yeah, said the adoptive parents. You clearly,
yeah, the same sex ones. As well.
Yeah, there's something not working out at all. We need to have a. Anyway, people have tuned in to hear Sarah Johal, haven't tuned in to hear this. This is just the cut and thrust of our normal banter.
It is.
Anywho.
You're right. Mm-hmm.
So we, I think it was the end of July. Sarah, you were given, were you given a new job or did you apply for a new job? Did you, I'm not sure how that happened.
I applied for it, Al, got interviewed and everything. Yeah.
Wow. So can you tell us your new job role? Because what were you previously? What are you now? And what does that mean?
Okay. Yeah. So up until the beginning of September, or even the middle of September, I was head of One Adoption West Yorkshire, which is a regional adoption agency for Bradford, Calderdale, Leeds, Kirklees and Wakefield. And then I applied for a new job, which was a newly created job called the National Strategic Lead for adoption, working with regional adoption agencies. So it's a new post, and the regional adoption agency leaders put together the job description. The post, and there's a kind of a small national team. It's been funded through the Department of Education through grants.
Right.
But the money has been provided to regional adoption agencies who have pooled that money together to provide some leadership. To chair their meetings and to take forward a kind of clear vision about how regional adoption agencies are going to work together in terms of the leaders group and develop and implement a plan with some key priorities. So that's essentially my responsibility, is to work with RA leaders to implement a strategic plan. And that's what we have been working on and are working on.
Excellent.
Yeah, it's quite cool though, because I mean, I've known you for a few years. I'm just saying.
Never drop names. Mick Jagger told me that.
And you were one of the first RAs to go live.
Yeah.
You were the first, actually. You weren't one of the first. You were the first, weren't you? One Adoption West Yorkshire.
We were, yeah.
And what I find fascinating about this role is the fact that it's taken this long to kind of decide that there was, that it needed some leadership. Do you feel the same way, or do you think that that was just a kind of, it was a, let's do it in kind of piecemeal fashion where each agency goes live and then we can look at it afterwards, or
I think it's been a gradual sort of a development, a period of development really, because I guess if you think about it from an RAA perspective, we still haven't got all local authorities completely yet in an RAA. There's probably two or three that are still waiting and kind of moving towards it, but not quite there yet. So there's only been, you know, three or four that have just gone recently live. So I guess from a developmental point of view, you needed to have quite a lot of RAA leaders and agencies up and running before you could then try and work cohesively together as a group. I mean, to be fair, we have been working on national agendas. So, for example, the work around the national recruitment, that's been going on for 2 years, and I've been quite heavily involved in that. So RAA leaders have already been collaborating, but there hasn't been any infrastructure in place to provide kind of a national team or to take this work forward, if you like, formally. So I suppose we've been doing it together in some smaller way, but this is on a slightly bigger scale.
Yeah.
Does that,
it seems sensible.
Like, it does seem to make sense. And but I was thinking, when it was announced, it sort of, I think it sort of aligned with our feelings, Scott, didn't it? That actually the Adoption Special Guardianship Leadership Board is slightly outside of that. And as much as it tries to influence the RAAs, it's only got it hasn't got any teeth. But actually, you being appointed as then that, you know, National Strategic Lead for Adoption, working with the regional adoption, that's a great title, by the way. I hope you have a name badge with that on, which is about 3 foot long.
It's like the Adoption and Special Guardianship Leadership Boards, isn't it? Why simplify things? Sorry. Yeah,
but does that mean that you feel like you've almost got permission, and they've sort of said, right, you can maybe drive through policy changes, strategic issues in a way that maybe the board can't. I mean, I'm maybe pulling you into politics, but the board can't.
Well, I think probably the main driver for this particular post is to look at that sort of structural reform program that's taken place and all the RAAs working together, and if you like, putting some emphasis on the collaboration that's happened between those RAA leaders and that kind of working together to be able to improve practice and improve services across England. I mean, clearly, I kind of will be reporting into the Adoption and Special Guardianship Leadership Board because that's something that I'm required to do as part of my role. So I'll be reporting in there, and I'll be reporting into, you know, the Association of Directors of Children's Services, who are ultimately accountable for the regional adoption agencies, and, you know, they're all hosted by local authorities or you know, certainly working with local authorities. So it's really important that I kind of report into those arrangements and also report into the DfE, because they've essentially funded the post, and I've got a small team working with me to try and help implement the plan that we put together.
So who is your boss? I mean, you've kind of said who is your boss? If that is maybe a, is that, well, is it too blunt?
No, it's not. It's not too blunt. And it's a good question. And people do ask me that quite a bit. And I guess I kind of am working to RAA leaders. So there are 31 regional adoption agency leaders, and I met with them this week, which was great to be able to see them all in person. I kind of chair their regular meetings, and we work together to collaborate and think about what's going to be their vision and what's going to be the plan and what's going to be the key priorities that we want to take forward. So technically, from my HR, I'm on secondments. I'm still employed by Leeds City Council. So my HR and grievances or anything like that, sickness, etc., will all be through Leeds City Council. But I'm not technically kind of line managed in that way. I go to a few people for support because I guess it's a very unusual sort of role, isn't it? It kind of has lots of different aspects to it, I think.
Yeah. And I was going to say, I mean, the people you're working with, I mean, And I'm talking from my experience of working with some of the RAAs when they were forming and when they launched and stuff. I mean, the heads of these RAAs aren't people who aren't visionaries. To me, they're all visionaries. They all want to do the best for adoption. They maybe don't get it right all the time. You know, I'm not saying they do. And obviously, it's a process. And you know, regional adoption agencies are also kind of work in progress. But that must be kind of a little bit of a kind of ooh moment when you sit in a room with 31 leaders who are all, as you know, they all want to kind of achieve the same thing. Is that how you feel?
It's really exciting, Scott. Really exciting. It's almost palpable, the kind of energy and the enthusiasm and the passion and really wanting to sort of make a difference, a positive difference to children's lives. And I think that's where they come from. You know, what really struck me about the group is that their value base about why they do the work and the reasons why they do the work feels really positive.
Yeah.
And I feel quite privileged to be able to work with them. And all the local authorities, of course, you know, they work very closely with the local authorities, and some RAAs work more closely than others. And it's really interesting for me to see the differences. And that's become much more apparent to me over the last couple of weeks, the huge differences in terms of the models of delivery and that integration with the local authority, which I think is absolutely key in influencing and helping shape care planning, for example.
I mean, I don't want to rain on YouTube guys' parade in terms of isn't everything tickety boo in the world of adoption?
Clearly not. But you know,
yeah. Well, you know, judging by our inbox, you know, we sort of people. Yeah, people don't get in touch and tell us how peachy, creamy things are, do they? There's a few issues that I'd like to kind of. The first one is that even. We're in a state now where some local authorities have still not transitioned, or agencies have not transitioned. Is there a sense that, you know, all the people who are in the vanguard, the people who said this is right, this fits with our, like those people with those values and those passion? Yeah, I can understand the first third half, but then there's been these, I don't want to say problematic, but local authorities that have just struggled to get on board, or a whole host of reasons. So I guess the question about answering what's going on, but also the whole aim was to share good practice. And is that what we're seeing? Are we seeing good practice being disseminated, or sort of are we going to the lowest common denominator in some of the RAAs? That was a big question.
Very big.
Well, it was a big question, but I think the aim is to share and learn from each other where the practice is good and where there is some good practice. And I think what you know, you've highlighted sometimes on your podcast is that it's not necessarily consistent across the country, and there are pockets of some really, really excellent practice, and I've, you know, seen that, and families have told me that, and it's learning from where that is working really well. Why is that working really well? What's the difference? And I know we're looking at an event in the spring, a good practice event to bring social workers and team managers together to be able to share some of that, so that actually people can learn from each other and ask questions. You know, in a way, when you've got 31 leaders as opposed to 151 adoption managers, the ability for them to get that kind of support and challenge from others is different, isn't it? The conversations are different than across 153. You can influence much more. And of course, all they have relationships with their local authorities, and it enables them to go back to their local authorities and say, actually, I've heard about that, and actually that's working really well, and that's really improving things for children. Maybe we might want to try that. So, you know, I think there's some really good ideas out there about how we can affect some change, some positive change for, you know, what is ultimately children's lives, isn't it, and families' lives.
Yeah. Have you had to bang some heads, though? I mean, to be blunt. No.
Oh, my God.
Not yet.
You've been doing it for like 3 weeks. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That's not really my style, Al. You know that.
I just have visions of Sarah going into slapping people around the back of the head, going, "Start now!" No, I know you definitely wouldn't do that. But what you've just explained there—that was the intention of the RAA process, wasn't it? For to kind of so that there wasn't 150 odd kind of age statutory agencies dealing with the same thing,
and
you know, it seems right that now is the time for this role, to be honest, to bring it all kind of cohesively together a little bit more. We've done the first bit. This is like maybe the second or the third bit. I don't know.
Yeah.
I suppose it is naturally the second phase, isn't it? It's tightening the screws now, isn't it?
Yeah, tightening the screws.
Sorry, I'm talking in idioms all the time.
Not literally.
It feels like a natural progression to me. It feels like, you know, this is timely. I think the work that we've done across the RAAs and with the voluntary sector and key stakeholders with the recruitment work, you know, has been really positive. And we've seen some really good pilot work that we've done around trying to recruit Black adopters, for example. You know, we've seen a 38% increase in the last year in registrations of interest from Black adopters, which is, you know, really positive. So, you know, we've got National Adoption Week this year. We've got a different emphasis this year, you know, hearing from those voices that we don't often hear about in adoption, but which is actually really important to help children have a good sense of their own identity and build a coherent narrative about their kind of past, their present, leading to their future. So I think there's been some excellent work that we've done across the sector, and that's been at a national level. You know, not everything needs to be done at a national level, but there are some things where it makes sense to pool resources and deliver it, because the number of children actually is quite small when you look at the children in the care population. You know, we're talking about quite a small number of children and families, really.
Yeah.
Can I ask then, I have got a list of topics. We do have one. We had one specific question that someone sent, which will probably fit in. But one of the things that I think has really started to slowly rise up the agenda to a point now where it seems action has to be taken is in relation to the voices of adopted adults. The voices of adopted people.
Mm.
But
yeah.
And it feels like a really delicate issue for a whole host of reasons. Right. So what would you be your aspiration? And how are we going to achieve that in relation to systemic involvement?
Yeah, so I think, the involvement of adopted people with adoption services, in my view, is absolutely critical and crucial at a local, a regional and a national level. You know, I know when I was working within One Adoption West Yorkshire, we commissioned PAC UK to do a lot of our work with birth parents, you know, we included them in helping us think about how we develop and shape services moving forward. And they had quite a lot of input into prospective adopters' preparation in terms of meeting with them, and we did some workshops. I'm kind of really... It's really important for me to think about that, not just adopted adults, but birth parents as well. So on a national footing, we've been working with Dee. I don't know if you know Denise Smalley.
Yeah.
She wanted to work with us as part of the National Recruitment Steering Group that I'm involved with. Developing some work about how to build and grow the voice and influence of adopted people in the national adoption recruitment strategy that we've been developing. And, you know, that takes time because we've tried to develop a bit of a reference group where it's kind of representative of adopted people from across the country, but also people who've been adopted at different times, have got different experiences, and making sure that we've got a good kind of breadth and depth of experiences that people can bring to the discussion. I've been in some of those conversations and some really challenging conversations from adopted people, and it's really helped me actually shift some of my perspectives and thinking sometimes about language and how we talk about and how we talk about things. And I'm really pleased to see the influence that they've had on some of the narrative that we've seen in some of the more recent recruitment campaign work, and particularly this National Adoption Week this year. But it's it's really important work, but it's also really important to support people on that journey, because it can be quite hard for people, you know, and it can be quite triggering, I think, when you're talking about adoption. And so it has to be done quite sensitively. It's not necessarily just about a little group, is it, Al? It's not just about a reference group. It's about how do you actually hear from people who you don't, who aren't, don't feel comfortable to talk about things, or are in different arenas, or so it has to be in lots of different ways that we kind of get views and opinions from people who've been adopted.
Because there's not one voice, is there, either? And I think that's the difficulty. Whereas there's probably a fair unity amongst adopters.
Yeah.
Whereas amongst the adoption community, there is such a spectrum. Adoptee.
Yeah.
That's my tongue tied. Adoptee community, there's quite a spectrum of views. And I think we've just seen that in the stuff that we do. You sort of mentioned slightly about supporting adopted people. And that's one of the. That's been an issue I've seen raised a lot about adopted people sort of saying, where do we get, you know, adopted adults, maybe in their 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s even, where do we get support? And then the restrictions through the legislation that it's got to be an Ofsted registered therapist. Is that something on the RA agenda? Is that something that you feel you've got a, you know, it's within your remit, or is it just something that's just a tricky?
Well, I think it's statutory services that we have to support people with access to their records. We have to provide advice, support and counselling for people affected by adoption. I think adopted people would say that they lack that support and it's not prioritised by local authorities or regional adoption agencies. And I know from my discussions, it's a real area that certainly the RAAs feel they would like to do more of. And like to be able to support people in a much more productive way. The reality, unfortunately, is that there are people who are waiting for services. In some areas, they do commission it. In some areas, they do it in-house. And again, it's that consistent word, Al, it's about consistency. It's not consistent across the country. Mm. But yes, I'm aware that people feel that their support is lacking, and I would have to agree with it. It is on the agenda. The agenda is absolutely huge, as you know. and I'm really pleased that this year we've got in National Adoption Week, we've got there was a conference run by adopted people for adopted people, and there I know that they're going to use some of that time to try and look at how we can try and encourage and support. Services that can support people, and I know there's some really interesting ideas about how we do that, whether that's peer-to-peer support, whether that's startup companies, other arrangements. I think, you know, there's been Adoptee Futures has recently been coming up, hasn't it, on Twitter, and I know there's other people in the arena looking at it, but yes, it's something that's a real concern.
Smashing.
And in terms of the kind of next part of that agenda from our perspective is the contact thing. I mean, you know, you're dealing with all these people. Are we listening to the, you know, the thing about contact, or we shouldn't even be calling it contact. We should be keeping in touch, or, you know, something along those lines. Is this on the long list?
Yeah, this is on quite the agenda. High up? It is actually, Scott. Yeah, and funnily enough, I was on a conference today that the Consortium of Voluntary Adoption Agencies ran. It was around this subject area, and there was a lot of people on that call. And there's a definite desire to address the issues and to look at it. And it's quite a complicated picture, isn't it?
Yeah.
But yes, it's definitely up there. And I think you're right. It's not about contact. It's about maintaining relationships, keeping people connected, again, so that children can have a good sense of their own identity as they grow and develop. And I guess one of the issues is that that's going to need support in terms of making sure that people are supported in that.
Yeah.
There's sort of different schools of thought around the whole issue about how you support people. But ultimately, you need to make sure that people are supported, and so that's a bit of a resource issue.
Yeah. And of course, the safety and security thing. I mean, every time we talk about this, I'm always conscious in the back of my head, you know, it has to be safe and secure for, yes, for the family, for the child, for the, yes, young people, whoever. So, you know, there's always that kind of thing to take into, yes, account as well, which, of course, you know, that doesn't come free to be able to do all those kinds of things. You know, it needs resource and it needs kind of time and kind of money put into it, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, there are some situations, and the thing is, every situation is individual, isn't it?
Yeah.
There are some situations where I know that adoptive parents really want to embark on restarting that relationship with the birth family and thinking, yeah, about the child and thinking about how they do that and want support with that. And so there's a lot of work for us to do with the sector as a whole, I think, in terms of social workers, because social workers will be anxious about the risks.
Yeah.
Sometimes adoptive parents actually feel confident that they can manage that. And actually, you know, I was talking to a social worker today who was at the conference, and she was saying that in COVID, she did quite a lot of work with birth parents who were anxious about their children.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, a few of those arrangements went on for the adoptive parent and the birth parent to sort that out themselves and you know,
yeah,
get their own connections. And in a way, that's what you want, isn't it? If that can be done safely and appropriately, then surely that's better than having an agency involved in the arrangements. But there are clearly those arrangements where you would need to have that,
yeah,
kind of support. But it's being able to be flexible and look at it. Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, sorry. Do you think that part of the problem is maybe the wrong word, but part of the challenges we're facing now is that we, you know, 2000 and whatever, 2, 3, 4, as the current legislation was drafted, and even 2011 when the national minimum standards were being formed, social media was either not existent or in its infancy, and we just weren't really prepared for the connectivity that we've got now. You know, for the first 10 years of my adoptive parenting, you know, it was just a letter. Now, literally, my stereotypical, yeah, angry teenage daughter is literally 3 minutes away from contact, you know,
yeah,
or literally. And so that just changes the whole how families feel about contact and safety. And then it links, yeah, into family story work, like, you know, story work, life story, yeah, work, risk assessment. It's in some ways the services are still playing catch up with that. Is that,
yeah,
maybe me? I don't know.
No, I think you're right. I think you're right, Al. I mean, if you look at the whole thing about letterbox, you know, who actually does exchange letters these days? I know I've got a friend who always sends me a postcard once a year, but apart from her, I actually don't get letters.
Yeah.
I normally get a WhatsApp or an email or something else. And I know we've been working with Linkmaker to pilot some new sort of up-to-date digital technology to help facilitate some of that, kind of modernize and facilitate a digital approach to sort of letterbox. And we're looking to pilot that next year with 3 of the RAAs, and sort of learn some lessons working with birth families and adoptive families and children and young people to try and pilot that. So it will be interesting to see how that shapes and develops over the next year or so.
Because I think as well that, yeah, we're having a bit of audio occasional hiccups, so forgive us. But we're going to push through. What the heck?
Yeah, we're going to be professional about it. Yeah,
be for professional. You don't see this on Good Morning in the Mornings, do you? I do wonder as well, is it about then we need to adjust preparation even at that very beginning for adoptive parents and saying, look, this is the world you're coming into. It's not this kind of this 1960s model where the adoption order comes and that's it, the end of it. It's the world, it's just different. It's not that anymore, is it?
No. Well, if you think about, I was talking to, again, somebody today about Northern Ireland, and the expectation is that there is contact unless there's an exception as to why not.
Yeah.
And it's a bit like, do you remember a few years ago we introduced early permanence and we thought, no, nobody's going to do that. And actually, you've got a lot of adopters who, yeah, have done that because, yeah, they know what's expected and they know, yeah, that it's right for the child. And if you keep the child at the centre of it, with regards to the debate about maintaining relationships, then if we're talking to adopters at information events or in preparation training, it's about actually this is really important for the child. Not only is the child coming to live with your family, you're going to live with the child's family, actually. It's your one family together, and it's important that that is understood. Yeah. And as you said, Scott, you know, that those safe connections can be maintained.
We're all pausing, waiting for the next feedback to come. I think the thing that I was somewhere today and I quoted Scott, which is quite a thing. I didn't attribute it to you.
Don't ever do that. I was going to say.
Well, no, it's just you said that this idea that we often risk assess, what are the risks of contact?
Oh, yeah.
Like you, the great quote, which is, what are the risks of not doing contact?
Yeah.
Arranging contact. I think that is just.
I think you should have said, you should have quoted me and said where that came from, actually, because that's probably one of the most cracking things I've ever come out with in 45 years.
It's like, I'm going to sit in a meeting and go, and as my friend Gay Adoption Dad would say.
Anyway, like, sorry.
No, it's fine. We've got a few more topics to get through. If that's okay, we've got a bit more time. Yeah. That's fine. I'm just maybe curious, and it's not necessarily something that's within your remit, but we've seen recently the news around the adoption apology there's been a parliamentary group, and there's been like an inquiry, isn't there, being called around the adoption apology. Do you think that's going to what do you think about that, and do you think there's going to be any fallout for the wider adoption community, recruitment, etc.?
Well, I mean, obviously, I've got my own sort of views about that. I don't know what the government's response is going to be. I know that there's the old parliamentary committee that's having a look at it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, from my point of view, I think we should apologise. It was a point in history that actually, and a point in society as well. Actually, you know, I've met many birth mothers who have felt pressurised either by their family or by their GP or by the whoever was involved. It could have been a midwife, it could have been a social worker, but they felt coerced because of the societal expectations at that time. And it feels right to me that actually we should apologise for that. I mean, I do believe that society has moved on and that adoption has moved on. Obviously, there was new regulations and new legislation that came in, wasn't there, later on, where that wouldn't happen. But it does feel, from my point of view, that we should be given an apology for that. But as I say, that's my personal sense. I don't know about the fallout. I don't think that, I mean, recruitment numbers are still quite, you know, good. In fact, we've got more adopters than we've had for quite a while. The issue for me is whether the adopters are the right adopters for the needs of the children that we've got waiting. Because there's a bit of a mismatch, I think, in terms of the current profile of children that we've got waiting for adoption. And we know those children wait longer, don't we, to find the right family. So it's important that we keep this child-centred and that children are at the heart of it, and that actually we find families for the children who do need adoption.
Yeah. And do you think that there's a bit of a contribution there from the kind of new guidance about not... So I don't know the exact words on this, so forgive me. But, you know, agencies can't say, we're not taking you through stage one, stage two, because, you know, we don't think that we would be able to match it. Do you think that's having a contribution or a bit of a factor in the numbers in terms of recruitment?
I think that's probably right. I think there is a bit of a concern about that from some agencies. I think it's really important that an adopter who have been through the process have been really clear that it's important to be open with people up front about, you know, the children that we have got waiting across the country who need adoption. And sometimes people shift their thinking, don't they? They come in with one ideal view about, this is the child that I'm thinking. And then sometimes they shift the view when they understand a bit more about the needs of that child and build a bit more confidence about the support that's available. So I think there's been some issues around that from agencies and how you manage that when actually you've got a finite resource.
Yeah.
And you want to make sure that we get the adopters for the children that are currently waiting. We don't want adopters to be waiting for a number of years, do we, without having a child. Well, it's not fair on them, it's not fair on the children.
Can I pick you up on a phrase you said there, which is finite resource? You've got a finite resource, which is children, isn't it? So, I mean, that's quite a, that's like management speak. It's a bit scary. I don't want to get be mean. But is there an ethical question around kind of continually driving through recruitment and raising people's awareness of adoption when there's potentially only a limited number of children? Because in some ways we've not really touched on, you know, there's a lot of people, a lot of adopted people who have lot big questions about the validity of adoption, the, you know, the future of adoption. That's maybe outside of your job role, but, and I don't want to I don't want to draw you onto the rocks, but
no, you know, I mean, I think,
let's see.
Yeah, I mean, I was talking when I was talking about finite resource, I was thinking about the capacity of local authorities to do everything. That's what I was meaning. I wasn't talking about children.
That's where my dark mind goes. Right? Some reflection on me than you.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the recruitment work that we've been doing has been very targeted around, for example, sibling groups. You know, we don't have enough adopters who can consider sibling groups. So that's why we've done some specific targeted recruitments around that. We needed to increase the number of black adopters. And that's why we've been doing some targeted recruitment about that. But that's why, you know, we're not doing as much national sort of recruitment, because we want to be very targeted about the needs of the children that are waiting.
Yeah. And I was going to say, going back to the original question, which was about this apology, we spoke to Pam Hodgkins, who's the founder of NORCAP, the other day.
Yes.
And it was really interesting to talk to her, because we asked her a very similar question, not the same question, a similar question. And it was very, I mean, Pam's view is it was very societal back in the day.
Wow.
And that an apology may be nice, but not quite, you know, I'm stuttering there because I just want to make sure I got my facts. But Pam actually said it's not kind of.
It was a surprise.
Not really necessary. Yeah, I was very surprised actually. Yeah, because she was very kind of clear that it wasn't something that she would want.
Which was interesting. I mean, very different views on it, isn't there?
Yeah.
It's very tricky. Am I right in thinking that the Scottish and the Irish and the Welsh parliaments have issued an apology? Am I right in that?
Oh, you're way ahead of us.
I might be wrong. I don't know.
I really don't.
Rings a bell when you say that.
Yeah, it does when you say it. Yeah. I mean,
I just think there's so much. I mean, it's a really difficult one.
I didn't say this with Pam. I'll say it here. Actually, it's very similar to the kind of the LGBT stuff, you know, when it was illegal to be gay and people were arrested and, you know, all that sort of stuff, there was kind of apologies made to certain kind of cohorts of that over the years in terms of the law changing and stuff like that. But I guess in terms of adoption, there was, unless it was a kind of what we class as a forced adoption, which I'm not going to go down the road of definitions on that, but people who class their adoptions or their children being adopted as forced adoptions, there was actually no law broken as such. So, you know, that's, I guess, where it becomes a shady area in terms of apologies, isn't it? And also, you know, the government being asked to issue an apology, the government's dealing with 2021 and what's to come and not 1950. So it's a bit of a kind of weird thing to, you know, to have that kind of discussion around, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
And it's difficult, isn't it, for those people who, you know, some people have come forward, haven't they? Other people haven't. There's so much sort of guilt and shame around for people who still can't talk about it. And obviously there's those children who have been adopted, you know, and are now adults. What's their views about it? Where do they, what's their feelings about it as well? It's a complicated picture, isn't it?
Yeah. Definitely. I mean, I think that we'll society changes, and that's the nature of society. So in 30 years time, will we be looking back now and saying, really, we just don't know, do we? But I guess we can only work with what we've got. And I think it was Hugh Thornbury said to me, and it was a really interesting phrase, because I was this was years ago, I was having a conversation with him, and he said, but as a society, we've decided that this is how we want to deal with those children who can't live with their parents, and we have to work with that as it is.
Yeah.
And if you want to change that, change that. But this is where we're at today. Which, anyway, you didn't come here to listen to us ramble on, did you? You came here to answer difficult Paxman-esque questions and put.
I was thinking, Hugh. we haven't seen him for a while.
Haven't seen Hugh for a long time.
No, exactly. No. Yeah.
I follow him on Instagram actually, and he's very active on Instagram.
He is very, so if you want to see what Hugh Thornbury is up to, you go to Instagram. Okay. I think last time we saw him was when he got married, actually. I think that was the last time before, that was a year before all this COVID stuff kicked off. Anyway, that's by the by.
I'm conscious that we've got maybe 5-10 minutes before we kind of wrap up because, you know, the dinner's on. Let's be fair.
Literally.
There's a few other things. I mean, the one question we did have was someone, and if someone was venting their spleen, that they were kind of just talking about time for a callback. Someone had called out for help to their regional adoption agency, and it had just taken a long time to get some, you know, it had taken weeks and weeks and weeks for someone to actually come back and help. I mean, is your role going to be able to kind of look at that sort of stuff at the kind of the minute level?
Yeah, that's a good question. So we did a piece of work around the what you might want to call the front door of recruitment end, and we're keen to look at that for adoption support. So a bit of a review of what's going on across the country in terms of how can people access support? You know, if they ring people, are they, you know, do they get a response? What's the turnaround of kind of the time? Just so that we can get an understanding of that to try and help agencies improve that where it might not be working, and they'd get feedback and they can try and improve themselves and learn from where it might be working better. So there are different arrangements across the country. I don't know exactly where it's working well and where it's not working well at the moment. I know there have been challenges. Kind of like that, a little bit.
It's Sarah. I want to speak to adoption support.
I mean, to be fair, that has been done for recruitment, hasn't it?
It has. And that did improve things, I think. That has improved things. And, you know, when you're able to feed back to you know, regional adoption agencies about, well, that was really good, but maybe you can help, you know, think about developing that, or you might want to put in a bit of training for staff around that. They have really welcomed that and have done something about it. So we wanted to try and look at that for adoption support and the front door of adoption support services.
Because, I mean, adoption support remains one of a key theme amongst the adoption community, the adopter community. And one of the things that I've seen debated recently is this idea of continued support. How do you develop links? Because some agencies, maybe social workers can hold open files that maybe things are just ticking along and there's no great crisis, but there are sort of a reference point or a contact point for families. Others, you dip in, and then you come out and you have to literally go back to the start. Do you think there is a model that works that kind of can, where social workers can keep a case, like keep people and keep that like lifelong connection? Because adoption is lifelong, isn't it?
It is. And I think there's also something about maybe stepping up and stepping down within a trusted agency or a trusted number of people that you've worked with over the years. And I think what adopters have told us is relationships are pretty key. And if they feel that they've had the relationship, they know they can go back. So I guess what we've been trying to think about is that universal offer that's available to everybody. So making sure that people are linked in to the agency in some way, whether it be your social groups or your activity days or your fun days or your family days or your newsletter, just to keep connected so that you know who those people are, so that if things do get a bit tricky, you know where your point of contact is. And I think the developments around the peer support services have been really, really positive. And building that sort of community of support has been really important. But then equally, if people feel actually I need a bit more, they know where to go and they can access that support. Yeah. And I think having seen across a number of different local authorities, there was a few models, one where they did have the social worker that was open, you know, and basically you could come back at any point. But the reality mm-hmm. is that the demand for support is so high that became impossible to do. But it's important that family get the support when they need it. But it might not always be that particular social worker, but it might be the team, or it might be the peer support team that's working with the agency. So it would be really good for us to explore that in a bit more detail about what works and what do families feel work, and what's the best way of doing that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess reflecting on my own, one of my experiences was that we just kept this... that I didn't want anything. I just wanted someone to write things down on a bit of paper for me. There was this trail of like, sounds terrible, a trail of evidence that would protect us as a family. So that was it. And I said, I'll ask you when I want something, but on the whole, could you just put notes on my case for me, please? And that reaped results, you know. But I guess I'm really system literate. I know that the challenges to having that and kind of put it in a terms that everyone went, oh, that'll work. But a lot of families aren't system literate, are they? It's a real difficulty.
I think that you've clearly got a lot of work ahead of you, Sarah, but in a nice way. I'm not talking like, you know, cracking heads on tables like Al mentioned earlier. I think the thing is, I've worked with you, so I know how sincere you are about this work, and it's not something that you take lightly. You know, we can all sit and moan about our RA and, you know, the social workers and blah, blah, but actually there are some really, you know, we've got some really good leaders there. And, you know, I would love to think in a couple of years' time that
there's we'll a job be on, for you?
You know.
Yeah.
Being cheeky.
Always. So yeah, good luck. We would love to have you back on in a year's time, if you're allowed to. If you're not banned from coming on by then, when they hear this and go, "Oh, you're never going on that again."
and I'm really sorry for casting dispersions upon your when you said resources. I'm coming out in a cold sweat.
See, my simple head knew exactly what Sarah was talking about, and when you said that, I was like, "That's not what she meant." So, you know, it's good that you cleared it up. Yeah, my simple brain.
That's
not
flush.
That's me. That's normally me.
Well, Sarah, if in a year's time, if you can, we would love to have you back on to see how things are going.
Update you on how we're getting on.
Exactly. But in the meantime, it has been a pleasure yet again having you on, and it is always a pleasure. So thank you for joining us tonight.
You're welcome. Yeah. Take care, guys.
And if you want us to come to your practice day and do a little podcast conference report for the masses,
we'd love that as well.
Okay.
All right, then. I'll fax you a memo. Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Bye.
Bye.